Campus FM presents Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajus.
Hello, and welcome to Classic Texts. As in previous weeks, we will go through a light-footed presentation of a Victorian work of literature. I'm Margaret Ajus, and this week's choice is The Great Gatsby, a dramatic and tragic novel set in a context of the long hot summer of 1922 in New York City. The author, F. Scott Fitzgerald, recreates the glamour and heartbreak of the American dream, evoking the affluent and optimistic jazz age of 1920s America. His characters go on a search for something which would ease the boredom of their empty lives amid much drinking and dancing. Nick Carraway, the young narrator of the story, arrives in New York City and rents a house for the summer on the unfashionable side of Long Island. His neighbor, Jay Gatsby, is a mysterious millionaire whose lavish parties are attended by crowds of people, none of whom seem to know the host. Nick visits his wealthy cousin Daisy and her arrogant husband Tom Buchanan across the bay in fashionable East Egg. Nick is dragged off by Tom to spend a drunken afternoon with his mistress Myrtle and their friends. Nick is disturbed by the cynical and unpleasant atmosphere. He attends one of Gatsby's huge parties and is intrigued by his host's melancholy aloofness. Gatsby has been in love with Daisy for years, since an earlier involvement, and has nurtured a dream of winning her back from Tom with his newly amassed wealth. A meeting is arranged by Gatsby, who meets Daisy for the first time in 5 years. He takes her round his mansion, showing off and wanting only her approval of his estate, car and clothes. In love again, Daisy continues to visit Gatsby, who is desperate to recreate his past with her. He believes she will divorce Tom and marry him, but week by week his dream slips further out of reach. A showdown between Tom and Gatsby occurs one afternoon, when Gatsby urges Daisy to tell Tom she never loved him. "Oh, you want too much," she cries, unable to deny her early love for Tom. Tom, in turn, mercilessly exposes Gatsby's illicit means of acquiring wealth, until Daisy can bear to hear no more. The afternoon hurtles towards its appalling conclusion, leaving only Tom and Daisy unscathed.
Yeah.
Great Gatsby is one of the great tragic heroes of 20th century literature. Obsessed with creating vast wealth and an impressive image in order to win back his first love, he loses touch with everything in his past and finally with reality altogether. The son of farm people, James Gatz left to the earliest opportunity and invented a new history and persona for himself. As Lieutenant J. Gatsby, he met Daisy in 1917. She was out of his class and out of his reach, but they fell in love. When Gatsby went off to war, Daisy eventually, tired of waiting, married Tom Buchanan. Gatsby sets about making his millions with the sole aim of impressing her. The huge house across the bay from her, the parties, the shirts from London are all for her. He insists with a single-mindedness that everything can be made the same again and that the past can be repeated. His determination to wipe out everything from his and Daisy's life, apart from their love for each other, verges on the insane. He is unable to see her as she is, to believe she has had a child or ever loved her husband. Unable to inhabit the present, Gatsby becomes a non-person, a non-participant in his own parties, where no one knows who he is. The following is an audio clip from the film The Great Gatsby, starring Robert Redford and Maya Farrow. The 1974 film has a screenplay by Francis Ford Coppola.
Tom, your husband.
I know who you're referring to.
Why did you marry Tom, Daisy?
I don't want to talk about Tom. Oh, my wedding. It makes me sad, and I want to be happy. You used to like to make me happy.
You didn't love it.
It was fine for you, wasn't it? Crowding into my life, riding in my white car, wearing your romantic uniform that hid who you were or where you came from, breaking my heart with your impossible love, and then going off to your great adventure overseas, leaving...
I told you I'd come back for you in my letter. You said you'd wait.
I've waited so long. We were so close in our month of love.
Why did you marry him?
Mr. Tom Buchanan, son of Mr. Tom Buchanan of Chicago, Illinois, blew into my life with more pomp and circumstance than Louisville ever knew before. He came down with 100 people in 4 private railroad cars. He hired a whole floor of the Mühlbach Hotel. He just blinded me with excitement.
He gave you a string of pearls, valued at $350,000.
Jordan Baker told you that, didn't she? Traitor. Well, what else did she tell you? Did she tell you how she found me that night? Lying there in my hotel room, drunk as a monkey, with a bottle of Sauterne in one hand. And...
my letter in the other.
I never had a drink before, I said, but oh, how I do enjoy it. And I pulled the $350,000 string of pearls out of the waste paper basket where I dropped them and said, here, dearest, you take these downstairs and give them back to whoever from Chicago they belong to and tell him all that Daisy's changed her mind. Daisy's changed her mind.
The next day at 5 o'clock, you marry Tom Buchanan without so much as a shiver.
You know what Jordan did? She ran a cold tub and dropped me into it, dress and all. And I couldn't stop crying, but I wouldn't let go of the letter. You let her. I hung on to it and hung on to it. Until it came to pieces in the water. Melted away like snow.
Why? Why didn't you wait for me?
Because rich girls don't marry poor boys, Jay Gatsby. Haven't you heard? Rich girls don't marry poor boys.
The Great Gatsby is not only a timeless love story, but is also a fascinating social document of 1920s America. Gatsby's vast riches will never lift him to their social milieu. His clothes are too vulgar, his display of wealth too ostentatious, and his elaborate formality of speech just missed being absurd. There is no room for sentimentality in a world of sophistication and cynicism. There is a stark contrast between the innocence of Gatsby's dreams and the dubious means he employs to realize it. Nick is the only character who is morally reliable. Revolted by the casual cruelty of the rich and famous, he admires Gatsby's straightforward and eternal search. To tell us more about the social commentary in The Great Gatsby is Carl Spiteri.
The Great Gatsby is Scott Fitzgerald's view of American social life in the 1920s. On the one hand, it is a vivid documentary of a life full of wild thrills and excess. And, on the other hand, it is a harsh criticism of the American dream that to Scott Fitzgerald seemed more like an empty promise than reality. 1920s America, or the Jazz Age, as it has now come to be known, was a period characterized by greed and moral corruption, where money and living life to the full, with no regard for consequences, took center stage. The great excesses of this social life are best described in the novel by the extravagant parties that were thrown by Jay Gatsby. Gatsby lived in a huge house, knew all the right people, and was constantly throwing parties for all those who really mattered. Food and drink were in abundance, and anyone who was important attended. One word, glamour, sums up this lifestyle, a word that resonates continuously in the descriptions of Gatsby's parties. In the main hall, a bar with a real brass rail was set up. By 7 o'clock, the orchestra has arrived. Cars from New York are parked 5 deep in the drive, and already the halls and salons and verandas are gaudy with primary colors. The air is alive with chatter and laughter and casual innuendo, and introductions forgotten on the spot, and enthusiastic meetings between women who never knew each other's names. The party has begun. But behind all the glamour, music and drink, Scott Fitzgerald was harsh in his criticism of a society that was greedy and artificial. The people who attended Gatsby's parties did not really care about the host. They did not even care about the other guests. All they did was eat, drink and dance, blind to everything else around them. It is this blindness that the author explores, a general alienation that had taken over the lives of affluent Americans. They indulge in drink continuously, irrespective of the time of day or occasion. Daisy, Gatsby's great love, gets drunk the night before her wedding to drown thoughts of her future. Jordan and Tom drive around recklessly, and when Nick, the narrator, remarks at Jordan's bad driving, she simply replies, "They'll keep out of my way. It takes two to make an accident." The author sums up the values of his generation as driving on toward death through the cooling twilight. Another strong commentary made by the author is his idea of the famous American dream. Politically, the American dream was a foundation of ideals and hopes, a dream free of class distinction, where every person has the opportunity to be whatever they hope to be. The social reality, however, was very different, and, according to the author, through the country's pretentiousness and decadence, the American dream is lost. Myrtle, Tom's mistress, is from a low social class. Her affair and connection with Tom represents the falseness and decay in class distinction. By attaching herself to Tom, she's renouncing her own social foundations and background, and attaching herself to social strata to which she does not belong. Her demeanor with other people of that social class only serves to emphasize her misplacement. Nick observes that she had changed her costume and was now attired in an elaborate afternoon dress. She was not being herself, putting on an act to perform as an upper-class lady. The death of the American dream is epitomized by Gatsby's life. He was not affluent by birth and had no money when he had first met Daisy. He earned his money later, thinking it would give him the opportunity to finally join the affluent and win over his true love. But, much to his dismay, he found that both his dreams were false. It is true that money placed him in a good position. His parties were a celebration of his wealth and the wish to be part of a social class to which he once did not belong. But, notwithstanding all his efforts, Gatsby was never accepted. His guests came to his parties but spoke about him behind his back and even avoided him. There is still a strong divide between those who always had money and those who had just acquired it. Nick remarks, "I glanced back once. A sudden emptiness seemed to flow now from the windows and the great doors, endowing with complete isolation the figure of the host." His second dream also fell apart. Although he finally became wealthy and, on paper, had what it takes to win over Daisy again, the difference in social class was still too evident. Daisy is presented as wealthy and comes from a rich background. Gatsby is rich, but comes from quite a different upbringing. He tries to impress her by showing her his house and his expensive shirts, but he never realizes his alienation. Even in the final showdown between him and Tom, when it was evident that Daisy was never going to leave Tom for him. Perhaps what is most tragic is that Gatsby dies while waiting for Daisy, and never really understands his unfortunate condition. He dies alone. No one went to his funeral, which Nick describes all too eloquently. The minister glanced several times at his watch, so I took him aside and asked him to wait for half an hour. But it wasn't any use. Nobody came. Here, we not only mourn the death of Jay Gatsby, but the death of his metaphorical counterpart, the American Dream. Our only hope lies in Nick, a man who always displayed strong morals, and through which the author seems to tell us that, beneath all the flash and materialism, there is something quietly breathing and alive.
Every morning, every evening, ain't we got fun? Not much money, oh, but honey, ain't we got fun? Somewhere, some hate, we have no fuss, but smiles for lady, for people like us. In the winter, in the summer, don't we have fun? Times are bum and getting bummer, till we have fun. There's nothing children, the rich get rich and the poor get children. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun? Landlord's mad and getting madder, ain't we got fun? Times are bad and getting better, still we have fun. There's nothing children, the rich get rich and the poor get laid off. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Scott Fitzgerald's meteoric rise to fame sowed the seeds of a tragic, drunken decline. He was born in 1896 in Minnesota, his beginnings humble. He was a precocious and vain schoolboy. In 1913 he went to Princeton, and its intimidating social hierarchies and systems of protocol strengthened Fitzgerald's sense of destiny. Fitzgerald started writing while making the most advantageous friendships. His writing achievements were beginning to earn him the sort of celebrity he craved. But in 1916, his continuing academic failure cost him the president of the Princeton Theatrical Triangle Club a setback he never forgot. Fitzgerald joined the army in October 1917 and began writing a novel called The Romantic Egotist, later developed into This Side of Paradise. He fell in love with Zelda Sayer, a high-spirited 18-year-old aspiring dancer. He went to New York after being discharged and tried to establish himself as a writer. The walls of his room were soon papered with rejection slips, and when Zelda called off their proposed marriage, the despairing Fitzgerald sought solace in drink. Finally, This Side of Paradise was published to great critical acclaim, and soon after he married Zelda. Fitzgerald also began to sell his short stories to the Saturday Evening Post. The popular magazine market would prove his steady source of income. At 23, he was rich and famous. He rode on the roofs of taxicabs and jumped into fountains, gave endless newspaper interviews, and got drunk at countless parties. His drinking started to get out of hand, and Zelda began to resent his success. They had a daughter, Scotty, as Fitzgerald worked on his second novel. The Beautiful and Damned received a disappointing reception when it came out in March 1922. Meanwhile, Fitzgerald became a spendthrift. He befriended Hemingway, and Zelda had an affair. Fitzgerald was now an alcoholic, and the marriage was on the rocks. Zelda's mental health deteriorated, and she was admitted to a Swiss clinic and diagnosed as schizophrenic, becoming catatonic and admitted to a psychiatric hospital. By 1934, Fitzgerald was a sick, tired, and depressed man whose writing skills were on the wane. He renewed his optimism with a contract for scriptwriting with MGM, and in 1940, he died of a heart attack. And we have come to the end of our programme for today. Credits go to the Great Writers Magazine for the script, the AV Library at the University of Malta for the film, and to Selene Bahajar for her technical expertise. I'm Margaret Ajuice. Join me again next week for another programme in the series.
You have just listened to Classic Texts, produced by Vicky Spiteri, presented by Margaret Ajuice.